Turing Pharmaceutical CEO Martin Shkreli was dubbed by some as the most hated man in America when his firm bought an AIDS drug and raised the price from $13.50 to $750 per pill last September. After public outcry, that price was lowered a few days later, but not to the original level.
Since that case, there have been high-profile increases of life-saving drugs, including EpiPens and insulin, causing some people to go without, which could have dangerous results.
And more people may be affected by rising drug prices because a growing percentage of Americans are covered under high-deductible health care plans. Part of the reason for that increase is that there are more of those plans available as part of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare.
Dr. Jeremy Green joins us now to talk about the ethics and practicalities of drug pricing. He's professor of medicine and the history of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the author of the book Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. Dr. Green, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back on the show, Veronica.
Well, is it just kind of the EpiPen that we're talking about, or are we seeing more frequent, bigger price hikes for drugs than we used to?
Yes, I'm glad that you're broadening the question. I think the past few years, and particularly the past 16 months, have seen an increased visibility of these older drugs that many of us have never thought would represent a pricing challenge in terms of access for patients, suddenly increasing in prices. And so what's happening with EpiPen is similar in many ways to what happened with Daraprim, Martin Shkreli and Turing Pharmaceuticals, what happened with doxycycline, with digoxin, with a number of other old drugs that have been staple workhorses of pharmacopoeia for decades and are now suddenly inaccessible to patients in terms of escalating prices. Now, the pathway is not the same with all these products, but the end result is very similar, that old drugs have become newly profitable and yet newly accessible to many people in America who need them.
So why hike the prices on old drugs? Why not hike the prices on the hot new drug?
Well, I mean, I think that if you're making the hot new drugs, you're hiking the prices on those as well. And there's many examples of how drugs coming out of biotech in particular are stratospherically priced at this point in time. A lot of attention followed in the wake of the release of Sovaldi, this breakthrough new drug for the treatment of hepatitis that was priced at a point to be inaccessible not just to individuals, but to break the budgets of state Medicaid and really presented a significant access problem. So it's not just old drugs that are high priced. I think that, though, we have really come to terms recently with the fact that just because a drug is off patent doesn't mean that it is accessible and affordable to people who need them. And that is a new awareness that we have of recent strategies that have taken place of taking advantage of monopolies on old drugs as well as new drugs.
When a pharmaceutical company is pricing its drugs or considering, you know, a hike, what sort of factors go into that equation?
Well, you know, I can't speak as a pharmaceutical executive, but certainly in terms of the behavior of companies, we see pharmaceutical companies pricing them at the level at which the market will bear. And a lot of this has to do with calculations of how much payers are willing to pay and who is exposed to that payment. So in the case of the EpiPen epinephrine auto-injector, a large part of the increasing profitability of this product to Mylan comes from the fact that most of the cost is paid by insurers. So for those who have insurance, the price of the drug, the price increase, wasn't visible. Of course, to people without insurance or to people at the margins going on and off of insurance, that price increase has been incredibly problematic. But I think this is a problem for this concept of how a company pursues a pricing strategy. I think for the most part, we have no strong rules to regulate what a fair price for pharmaceuticals are. So the answer is what the market will bear.
Got a clip here of former Turing Pharmaceutical CEO Martin Shkreli in December asking if he would have done anything differently when raising the price for the AIDS drug, and here's what he had to say.
I probably would have raised the price higher is probably what I would have done.
Why?
I think healthcare prices are inelastic. I could have raised it higher and made more profits for our shareholders, which is my primary duty. And again, no one wants to say it. No one's proud of it, but you know, this is a capitalist society, capitalist system, and capitalist rules, and my investors expect me to maximize profits, not to minimize them or go half or go 70%, but to go to 100% of the profit curve that we're all taught in MBA class.
So he would have raised the price even more because the price is not elastic. What do you think about that clip and what it reveals about the way drugs are priced and maybe being a price hiked right now?
Yeah. So, I mean, one way to read Shkreli's comments early on in this fiasco was that he was performing a kind of reducto ad absurdum, taking the ridiculousness of drug prices in the brand name innovative sector and then retrospectively applying them to old off-patent drugs and saying, well, if that drug can be this expensive, then my drug should still be able to be this expensive, even though I did nothing to develop it. So it's not surprising that many within the pharmaceutical and biotech industry quickly worked to distance themselves from the actions of Shkreli and Turing Pharmaceuticals or from the actions of Valiant Pharmaceuticals, which made similar arguments in the public sector that, listen, we have acquired companies that are selling their products essentially in monopoly situations at very low prices when they could be sold for much higher. So it is our responsibility to our investors to unlock the true value of these products, the value being the fact that in a monopoly situation, you know, market forces are going to be inelastic, that people will pay whatever we ask them to pay for them. That being said, it does puncture, if you read that argument all the way through, it punctures a lot of the mythology around the necessity for high prices in the innovative drug sector as well as generic drug sector. So in the case of Mylan, I haven't spoken with the CEO of Mylan, but if you look at some of Bresch's comments on the pricing of the drugs, they reflect, she essentially seems to be saying, listen, this is a life-saving medicine. There's all of these medicines out there that don't save lives. But our medicine, the EpiPen and epinephrine auto-injector, saves lives. And if you value a life being saved, then you should value our medicine more. We should be making more money off of this product, even though we didn't develop it. We didn't do the R&D behind it. So there's a similar logic moving across these spaces of recapturing old drugs that somehow do not have competitive markets, claiming that the value of these drugs then mandates that higher prices should be charged, and perversely taking some of the most robust, accessible, essential drugs that have been with us for decades and removing them from popular accessibility.
We're talking with Dr. Jeremy Green right now, professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and author of the book Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. We're talking right now about recent increases in medication prices and what alternatives might be there. And Dr. Green, looking at the issues, what you pointed out there, that some of these drugs are being priced in what amounts to a monopoly system. What about antitrust laws and the possibility of regulation? How does that play into the way that drugs get priced and whether anything might change?
Sure. I think there's antitrust laws on the one hand, and I think there's the broader structure of policy as to how we in the United States try to balance the demands of innovation, making sure that pharmaceutical companies are willing to put forward the capital in order to develop new drugs for the future, with access, making sure that once those drugs are developed that actually the American public has a reasonable chance of getting access to an effective drug when they need it. And in many ways that bargain was set in 1984 with the passage of a remarkable bipartisan piece of legislation popularly referred to as the Hatch-Waxman Act, which balanced the needs of the prescription drug industry by extending patent life, but also helped to clear a pathway for a generic drug industry so that generic drug manufacturers didn't have to prove that their medicine was effective, they didn't have to prove that it was safe, they just had to prove that it was the same thing or similar enough to the original product. Now, I mention this because in other countries, there were different ways of trying to make drugs accessible, different ways to balance innovation and access. Many European countries with a strong national health service use that buying power of the state to actually bring down prices and make sure they're fair and accessible. But in the United States, we preferred a free market approach, trusting that when a drug went off patent, competitors would swoop in and bring down the price of the drug. And if you look at what's happened since 1984, that has been tremendously successful in most parts of the pharmaceutical sector. But we do find examples, and epinephrine is one of them that has become very, very visible. But, Daraprim is another, albendazole, an antiparasitic agent, is another, albuterol is another, the inavailability of generic insulin is another, where we find really important, essential medicines invented a long time ago that have no meaningful generic competition right now. And we're just coming to terms with the fact that the generic solution for bringing prices down has not worked in all parts of the pharmacy.
So what kinds of solutions might there be for that? I'm sure generic insulin, for instance, would be an incredibly useful thing for the over 29 million Americans who suffer from diabetes and need insulin. So what's the holdup and what could happen?
Well, there's a number of different ways of framing this problem. And there are a group of actors out there that will say, well, the whole problem is regulation. There's a high regulatory barrier. In order to prove similarity, the FDA demands a series of very different, complex series of proofs to show that a drug is not just chemically the same thing, but is also biologically the same thing. And this is part of the problem in the epinephrine space. One of the reasons why Mylan still has such a dominant grip on the epinephrine auto-injector market is that Teva, the attempt by another large, pharmaceutical firm with a large generic presence, Teva's attempt to market a generic equivalent effectively failed. And it failed, on as far as I can tell, in terms of difficulties of demonstrating that the distribution of the medicine in the body once injected was biologically equivalent to Mylan's original product, to the EpiPen product. That being said, you have to ask yourself a question. Let's say the medicine seeps into your skin at a slightly different rate. If you're still injecting a decent amount of epinephrine in your body and you can afford it because it costs $5 instead of $600, is the slight difference in the biological profile of the drug enough to justify maintaining an effective monopoly? And I think these are tough questions we have to ask ourselves about what levels of standards of similarity we'll hold ourselves to in producing generic drugs when they are increasingly beginning to have market effects that appear detrimental.
We're talking with Dr. Jeremy Green from Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, talking about recent increases in drug prices and what alternatives there might be in a for-profit medical system.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to news stories lately about large increases in drugs like the EpiPen and insulin? Do you rely on these prescriptions? Have you or a loved one been personally affected by the price hikes, or worry about what you do if drugs you take regularly got more expensive like this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation now with Dr. Jeremy Green about recent dramatic increases in the cost of some drugs and whether there are options to make the system more affordable to consumers.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think changes are needed in how drugs are developed, who owns them, how generics are priced and produced? Have you been affected by the increase in cost of things like insulin or the EpiPen? Or is there a drug that you take that's gotten a lot more expensive? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Carol on the line first in Green Bay. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have MS, and I was diagnosed just over 4 years ago. It was August 9th of 2012. And the pharmacist tried to warn me from the first place. Now, you can't get any of the MS drugs from a pharmacy. They're just not carried. We go through a specialty pharmacy from some of the big players, from some of the big drugstore chains. But so when I first called my insurance company, they said maybe you can take another drug. The pharmacist said it's really high priced. And I said, well, how much can it be? I mean, like 400, 500. She said 4,000. I'm like, what? And there are many more drug therapies today. But since that time, she was right. It was about 5,000 that I paid in 2012. Today, those same drugs are 10,000. You know what? I have Medicaid. I'm covered. I've had to, fight, and the pharmacists have fought for me. There is no generic treatment for MS. There are no drugs that are out there like that, and they all run about the same price. This is my comment, though, central to this, is that I'm not given to cynicism, I'm not given to anger, but it was a pharmacist who actually told me that there are deals that the drug companies make then. We're talking about big pharma making deals with big health insurers, and that the pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies work together, and this way the insurance companies will cover one drug before another drug.
I see. Carol, thank you so much for sharing. And those are pretty big prices she's looking at there. for MS drugs, Dr. Green. And is this something that consumers, I mean, is there anything to what Carol was suggesting at the end, that she has been told that insurance companies and drug manufacturers work together to bring about the biggest profit there?
Well, you know, you'd think that the two groups would balance each other out, that insurers want to pay as little as possible to achieve health benefits, and pharmaceutical firms want to charge the largest prices they can for the volume. And yet there are problems. There are any attempt to make the system more efficient also creates new pathways for marketing. So there's different groups that act as middlemen. One is a group called pharmacy benefit managers, which help to collect together volume purchasing and help steer the formularies or what kinds of drugs are listed as top tier or lower tier or available for one insurance versus another. And there's another group of middlemen called GPOs, or group purchasing organizations, that simply help to bundle together pharmaceutical purchases for hospitals. Now, all of this is to say that the pharmaceutical marketplace is not just a place in which buyers and sellers meet in the middle in an open agora, which is where we would hope to see some sort of perfect competition, always bringing prices down when things are off patent. There's lots of different players in the middle. It's very hard for those of us who study pharmaceutical prices to even know what a drug really costs, because the true costs are hidden in these kinds of bundling deals, and the actual prices paid are considered to be a form of a trade secret. So she's entirely correct about this, and this is a significant problem. I know Congress has become increasingly interested in ways of holding hearings to open up this process and say, well, where along the value chain does a drug get so expensive? But right now it's actually very hard for us to study that.
Well, Carol, thank you so much for that call, and good luck to you. And we're going to go next to Ruth in Prairie du Sac. Ruth, hi.
Hi. I just find that the cost of, as a type 1 diabetic, as a result of surgery, $25 I have to spend every month, that's with insurance for the test strips, is just, ridiculous. That's 1 month's worth of, testing, and I have to do that 3 times a day minimum.
Ruth, thank you so much for that. And Ruth, looking at prices that are rough for her to handle, $25 a month. And, we were talking earlier about there being a lack of generic drugs for diabetes, and Carol was talking about lack of generics for MS. So what hope is there to bring down costs for people who are suffering from these conditions?
Yeah. A lot of this has to do with the way that we reward innovation. And Ruth is very right in pointing out, even if insulin was free, which is far from free, you can pay up to $200 a vial for insulin per month if you have no insurance and you need certain kinds. But even if insulin was free, the person living with type 1 diabetes still has to deal with a host of different and changing test strips and glucometers. And if you look out there in the market of these products, which are sold to people who need them in order to manage their conditions, that there's no single standard of test strips that will work in any machine. So if you shift from one machine to another, you need to buy a new batch of test strips. There is no generic test strip. This is an arena that could have easily been standardized earlier, but the way that market forces have taken shape in American medicine has led to a proliferation of different technological platforms, each one of which is actually still quite expensive, rather than a standardization which leads to a lower price and that's easily accessible. So if we think of these things as essential goods that people need to live in today's society, then the strategies in which individual companies continue to tweak products and hold patents and hold monopolies on these products can be perpetuated in a way that's very inimical to the public health.
Ruth, thanks so much for the call. We'll go next to Brian with a brief call, hopefully, from Madison. Brian, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
Well, I'm on Humira. I have arthritis. And the price just jumps all over the place. I'm 65 and I'm on Medicare now. So, and it's not a life or death situation with me, but I'm worried about the high prices and the possibility of a generic. And I don't like the taxpayers to have to handle my arthritis drug.
Brian, thank you for that call. I appreciate it. And Brian he's kind of looking at the big picture there, worrying about the taxpayers helping to finance his medication. And what would you say to him, Jeremy, about what this could mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is a very significant problem that we have to address. We tend to think, you know, American medicine is very innovation-centric. We want to reward innovation. We want that innovation to continue. And yet for that innovation to reach the greatest number of people, it needs to translate somehow. And the stories that we tell ourselves that innovation is rewarded merely during a short period of time when that innovation is under a patent, and then it becomes broadly available to all. Well, we have many, many examples in which that does not come to pass. And so if the innovation that is being promised to the American taxpayer, the American citizen, is not actually translated in a way that can be effective and sustainable, then the whole system really comes under significant stress. And you're right to think about taxpayers, because this additional money, the clip you played from Martin Shkreli earlier is telling, because here you have a sense that, as Shkreli argued, well, individual patients don't need to bear the cost. It's their insurers. But once you extend that outwards, it becomes the insurers, and especially for public insurers, it becomes the taxpayers. It becomes part of the process by which large municipalities go into default because they cannot continue to handle the increasing costs of benefits and of pensions moving forward. So this becomes a problem for the fabric of American society in general, not just for the individual patient.
Now, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks again.
That was Dr. Jeremy Green from Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, where he's a professor of medicine and the history of medicine. And he's also the author of the book Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. He joined us there to talk about the ethics of drug pricing. This is Central Time.